Hello, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Well, we're up to bringing ourselves a lot of the arts and music that West Wisconsin culture is very well known for. And that's what this program is all about. It's called Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Good to be with you on this Thursday morning. We repeat on Friday evenings on the News and Classical Music Network, so hello to you, too. It's a Friday. Today, Emily Saliers is one half of Indigo Girls, an iconic duo who, for nearly 30 years, has brought strong music and even stronger lyrics to the CD players and digital devices of at least a couple generations. And their music doesn't dilute with the passing of time. They continue to bring us fresh, new stuff. And they'll bring it all to the State Theater in Eau Claire in less than a week. Emily Saliers and I had a chat on the phone, and I'll share it with you a little later on. Jim Oliver is here with the experienced and talented Mary Cutler, who will occupy her director's chair for the upcoming production of Agatha Christie's A Murder Is Announced, opening September 12th at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. And let's dive right in and swim around in the Spectrum Pool. Right here. Ever been to a farm? How about a fish farm? We have a very good and interesting one right in the middle of who we are in Western Wisconsin. One hot Sunday afternoon not long ago, I visited the Bullfrog Fish Farm. And David, a specialist who'd rather just be called a fish farmer, was giving me a tour.
Well, the air line there helps create a flow in the tanks and also is adding oxygen. They always seem to be swimming up that way. I'm feeding them about 2 to 5 times a day. Some of the smaller fish eat more often throughout the day. It's a special pellet for meat-eating fish, so there's a lot of protein, vitamins, and minerals.
That's the sound of fish feeding, folks.
Bullfrog Fish Farm was the brainchild of a guy named Herbie. And for many people, that one name is all they need to hear. He and his establishment are that popular. If the name Herbie doesn't immediately ring a bell, how about this?
Eat my fish!
Now we've got you. Eat my fish is the mantra you'll hear many times a day if you're a guest at the Bullfrog Fish Farm, whose mailing address is Menominee, but it's at the end of a gravel road, and you'll swear there isn't a city for a long way. It's a place to fish for trout. It's the home of weekend entertainment and shore lunches in the summer. It's where you can hear live music and take a tour of what it is they do and how they do it. Above all that fun and social cavorting, the thing you find from talking with Herbie is that Bullfrog, in its most honest and true personality, is a farm. And Herbie is proud of being a farmer. He wants to do what he can to preserve farming, family farming, the kinds of farms we've been losing at a too rapid pace for decades.
You are the sole proprietor. Now, at one time it was S-O-L-E, now it's S-O-U-L. You became an LLC. You got to be sophisticated.
But soul is good. It works. Yeah.
Tell me about the preservation of character on the logo. I spent a lot of time on your website yesterday, so I have a lot of questions that relate to those kinds of things. The preservation of character.
More direct meaning would be my advocacy, education, and promotion for what I'll call the newer traditional family farm. Okay. Our goal here is... or has been, to use ourselves for a model or an experiment to see what it takes to bring the family farm into the next century. And that's been underlying to this business all the way through. Mm-hmm. But then I began to realize that some of our urban friends identify with it. So then I added to it as a tagline, and notions in humanality.
I like that word, humanality. Yeah.
The humanality term has been was stolen. I was touring a couple of brothers, 6 and 8, and at the end of the tour, one boy says, Mr. Bullfrog, you have a big humanality. And his brother says, no, you mean personality. And the little one said, no, I mean humanality. Yeah. And I've adopted that word ever since.
I like it. Okay, so you brought up the idea of the preservation of the family farm. So in my notes here, as I was preparing, I thought, you know, I have to ask Herbie about what's the difference between farming and fish farming. I think we all have a notion of what farming is about. They get up at dawn and there are crops and they have chores. What's the comparison between farming and fish farming?
Well, they're all farming. They're all farming.
Because there are animals involved?
We're raising a product. That it happened to fit me when I discovered the water here. The notions of raising fish kind of fit my passion as a kid, where I'd take salamanders out of the window wells and tadpoles out of the pond and put them in tanks, and I was building forts. And
where did you grow up?
Grew up in Roseville and Shoreview, Minnesota, which at that time was more like this. It was more rural.
And you bought this land and then just discovered water on it, and that's how the change of pace happened?
Yeah, the land, we bought a piece of property for housing for five families, and then the year after, this piece of property here became available, and my wife and I earmarked it for some sort of a rural business, but we didn't know what it was going to be. We tried to create some, you know, by sitting down and thinking about it and throwing ideas on a piece of paper, but they all seemed kind of phony after a while, so I started what I called the bullfrog business, which was named after the housing community. And I picked bullfrog because it didn't mean anything. At that time, I needed $1,000 a month to live, so my job is under bullfrog business was to come up with $1,000 a month ideas. And in time, they evolved around. It was landscaping, painting. Work along with youth projects was one of my favorites. I'd go into a farm and basically kind of hang out with the family for a couple of weeks or a month or a day or whatever. It was a good way to get to know the neighbors. Plus, that other part of that business was I started a rubbish removal. That was part of it, too. So my garbage truck had rubbish removal, marriage counseling, work along with youth projects, landscaping, painting.
You know, I think the very cool thing about what's happened to you here, and how many years?
This adventure started in the March of 87.
So it's been a while.
Yeah, and it took 7 years to get a fish. So it was March of 94.
It's kind of like ginseng farming. It takes a while to get that going, too.
Well, I think it took a while because it's a working class endeavor. There's no silver spoon here. I always say my spoon is wooden.
As I started to say, though, the really cool thing is, for you, it appears, this didn't turn out to be just a business. What you're doing is the choice you have made for a lifestyle.
Yeah, it takes that to satisfy me. An old saying from mine is that if it weren't for money, I'd be a rich man. So if we hadn't had the vision or the mission, we probably should have thrown the towel in a long time ago. But it was the mission that kept the thing going here, and that, again, was to realize how the family farm, what things we have to do in order to transition in the next century. It's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's been my mantra during this whole time of building the farm. So I have accumulated a lot of things. I haven't written them down. Mm-hmm. I have the notes from the sole proprietor. I wrote down those things. Just one of the liners.
Yeah, those are nice.
Yeah, and I tried to organize my thoughts, but then I realized that my thoughts didn't come to me organized. So maybe that'd be an untruth too, you know?
You need a thought organizer. You need to employ one.
I kind of go all over the place. I can't keep up with them, you know? Uh-huh. But part of my youth in Roseville and Shoreview was my family were vegetable farmers going to farmer's market, and that was kind of the lifestyle that I remember and am fond of, and what my wife and I were trying to get back to was the rural living experience. Mm-hmm. I wasn't old enough to pick up the skill of being a vegetable farmer, but I was old enough to know that I liked what I was living in. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest happenings is back in the mid-60s, during my time of puberty, the Beatles came to town, the freeways came through, and things changed really fast. You really can't go home anymore because it's not like it was. Yeah. So coming 80 miles to the east was kind of like coming home.
Yeah, it's kind of like going to a perpetual rock concert here. This is like Woodstock or Iola.
One fellow we hired here, after being here for about 2 weeks, he says, at a glance, it looks like there isn't much to do. But he found out he was really wrong.
You know, one of the things I like about your website, and I spent, as I said, some time on it yesterday, you use the word gumption, and I like that word, and it's not used very much anymore. In my estimation, not nearly enough. If you check a thesaurus, and by the way, you have to say a thesaurus, you can't say the thesaurus, because then you end up talking like that.
Okay.
There are many, I think.
That there was one.
Well, there was Roger. He gets credit for the whole thing.
Okay.
I don't know why.
I
don't know who Roget is, but...
Roget's thesaurus. When we had to look it up, we didn't have Google or any of that stuff.
I'll have
we had
to remind you here that I do have a lot of class, but it's all low.
You do a little stand-up here, too, don't you, on Saturdays and Sundays? So now, here's what thesauruses say about the word gumption. Words that mean the same thing are sense, initiative, although I came up with infishiative, so I just thought you might get it.
Okay.
Resourcefulness, get up and go, courage, bravery, mettle, and here's one, pluck.
Pluck. To be able to take from, huh?
So tell me about gumption. You use that word because of what? It took it to start this, it takes it to continue it, what?
Some of those terms I'm imagining in my head, whether it's true or not, that they're older words. I witness, as I'm 65 years old now, or will be shortly. Sometimes just changing up a word will bring it a new meaning. Mm-hmm. Two words may mean the same thing. But I do have a history of watching a lot of Westerns. I love the Westerns language. So some of those are old stuff.
Like Mosey?
Mosey. See, that's all good stuff to me. I feel at home with it, and it seems to, when you use it, it helps you project your message. One of my favorite things about the fish farm is that it has provided me with a soapbox, and I like the soapbox.
Good, good.
I also say that's part of a lifestyle.
Yeah.
Learning, having a soapbox, learning is very important. This is a very big learning place.
Mm-hmm. You don't stop learning.
You don't stop learning, and you love learning.
We're talking with Herbie. He's the sole, S-O-U-L, proprietor of Eat My Fish, Bullfrog Fish Farm, it's called, and we are in the hinterland somewhere near Menominee and Downsville and everywhere else. You know, we talked about traditional farming. Traditional farmers, they get to know their animals. Do you ever get close to your fish?
People who don't raise fish think they all look alike. But they really don't. You can't get to a point where you can recognize your fish. Now, that's maybe something that David has become better at than me, because in a way I've kind of become a phony. But it has been my job since 2000, with the beginning of the LLC, to learn to become a business person. As far as I got before that point was bootstrap businesses.
Okay.
And so I found myself taking a short course in financial management, which at one time you would have had to pull me under, kicking and screaming.
Yeah,
at that time, I was like a bad boy in church. I couldn't get enough, you know.
Yeah.
Things I had to learn here. How you doing?
He's a popular guy. People walk by and they wave at Herbie.
Yeah, so...
sometimes you have to face your demons head on, and then it sometimes, as well, turns out to be not that big a deal.
I found there was lots of creativity to be had in business.
Yeah.
And what's funny, too, is that for a guy learning or trying to go beyond bootstrap, a lot of my teachers or people I learned from have been women trying to break into business.
Oh.
I had more in common with some of the women there. They were as unfamiliar as I was.
That doesn't mean you cross-dress once in a while, does it?
No, that doesn't mean that, okay, but we won't tell all my secrets.
No. Well, you can tell them to me. I won't necessarily tell the audience.
You won't broadcast.
You have my promise that there are some things that won't make the airwaves. Again, we're talking farming. Are there, some of these may come out as stupid, but are there fish shows? I think about farmers and young kids, you know, 4-H showing their animals at a county fair. Do people show their fish? Can you win awards
for
fish?
That's part of the tradition that wasn't. Fish farming was not part of that tradition,
right.
You know. But what is the tradition is the spirit of the family farm. And one way I kind of judge myself as being in tune with the cosmos, so to speak, is when you find yourself coming to the same conclusion as other people without ever talking to them. Well, it's like buying a pink car and then realizing you think, oh, this is the first pink car I ever saw. Then you see all these other pink cars after you buy one, you know. But when you decide to be in the face of the small farm is dying, all of a sudden you start meeting other people with a passion to figure out how do we do it. How do we do it nowadays?
So what are you doing to help the family farm continue?
By example is the best, and by learning.
You're working with other small farmers.
I did more in the past. We used to have a place in Eau Claire, and my friend Pam started through a not-for-profit where we had a value-added conference.
Hmm.
And that was a fun time because I actually kind of moved away from the Fish Farming Association on a real tight, hard-working effort there. And I kind of started to see myself less as a fish farmer, but more as a farmer in this traditional farm, family farm movement, where we'd go to these conferences and be all these other people with funny hats and no money. And that had come to the same conclusion, where how do we make a living? How do we do this? But there were alternative things. Maybe fish would be closer to an apple orchard or an asparagus person or a mushroom person, mm-hmm. or things that are kind of require the family farm to do it, but it's not corn, it's not grain, it's not dairy. Although there's dairy people in that too. There's people who milk their cows and make their own ice cream. That's part of it too.
Are there fish farmer daughters jokes?
I have a fish farmer's daughter. It's my daughter. That was when she worked with me for a while. I called her the fish farmer's daughter.
Because there were always farmer's daughter jokes.
Yeah.
Remember those?
Yeah.
So the salesman stopped at the farm and, you know.
As a farmer with a daughter, you imagine what I thought of those things, you know.
I can tell, yes. You know, aside from keeping the small farm going, and that's one of your passions, you are all about the proliferation and preservation of trout.
That would be a common misunderstanding about me. People think that I'm a fish farmer because I used to be this fisher who liked to fish a lot. And there was many years as a kid where that was my job, to catch fish for the family meal. Okay. Even though I was Lutheran at that time, my buddy was Catholic, and it was his job to catch fish for a Friday. It was my job, too. So it was a kind of a good job to have as a kid. So that was part of the fondness, and maybe what when I discovered water made me think of fish. But as far as our business, we do very little stocking. We did more in the beginning, but less now. I'm going to imagine that the next generation that takes this farm on will probably be doing more of those. I could imagine hooking up with sportsmen's clubs or whatever, and forming relationships to stock community lakes or whatever. I can see that as a potential market. This is for sure a first-generation farm. Mm-hmm. And when you get to be my age, you start thinking generationally, because you just can't get everything you think done. Right. Your feet just don't go as fast as your head.
Look into the crystal ball. How long does Herbie do this kind of thing?
That's a real issue. There's a lot of us from that same group of farmers I talked to you about earlier that started farming in the mid-80s or building their farms or whatever, and now they're in their 60s. Now, what's the challenge here? Do we just leave 25 or 30 years of experience go? And so it becomes, again, a similar problem that the family farm had, is how do you pass it on to the next generation?
And not just the property, but the passion.
The passion, yes. We try to encourage anybody who works here on the farm to be their own character. Preservation of character, okay. We're all a bunch of characters. Mm-hmm. We tend to call ourselves proud and talented misfits.
Yeah. While we're talking about those kinds of things, on your website, I was reading some of your realizations and notes. One from the year 2000 that caught my eye was a response that you gave to a friend of yours who said that you should travel more. And I thought your response was very cool. You said, "I have been as deep as he's been far." That phrase in itself is deep.
Yeah.
So what have you found in your depths, Herbie?
It's part of who I am. We're all have different traits or characteristics. I have been one that's always kind of gone deep. Life experiencing, soul-building experiences. I think I was a child advocate for a number of years and raised kids. Those are all things that call you to go deep. That's just part of who I am.
Are you a better man now than you were almost 30 years ago when this thing opened up?
Always. Yep.
Every day?
Every day? Well, in a real general sense, yes, I do get smarter every day. But or every year. I was a person that was told by the school system that I was stupid, and I believed until I was almost 30. Now I'm going to school. Yeah, eat my fish!
And what would that be that just happened?
And that's a dinner bell and calling people to eat their fish.
So when I order something, that's going to happen?
That'll probably happen.
Oh, no,
yeah, right. I didn't know if I finished that thought. What was the thought there?
We were talking about being a better person.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, it's a learning place. For a person who believed, for some reason, that he didn't like learning is absolute for me. It's I love to learn and love. That's what it's about for me.
Keep up the good work, man.
You bet. Thank you very much. Eat my fish.
That's Herbie. The Bullfrog Fish Farm, just north of the Chippewa River, a little southeast of Downsville and Menominee, within shouting distance of the Red Cedar State Trail. It's at eatmyfish.com. It's fun, and it's important. Thanks to everyone there for their hospitality, and hey, eat his fish.
Support for WPR comes from Visit Winona, where the lake and river water trails provide the opportunity to glide, paddle, and drift through the seasons. It's the year to discover Winona. More online at visitwinona.com.
Here's a Spectrum memo. Saturday is Prairie Days from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. It's Simply Done on County Road C, Menominee. Plein air painting, creating swags from native plants, presentations on gardening, soil, birds, conservation, and a guided prairie walk. It's a free public event. The website, simply-done.com, and theprairieenthusiasts.org. Go there to chapters and find the Chippewa Savannah's chapter link. The United Way Community Block Party is Saturday at Irvine Park in Chippewa Falls. It's 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Entertainment, food, fun, activities, and more. Friday evening, UW Eau Claire presents a concert at Owen Park, Thick as Thieves, with special guest The Lately at 8 p.m. This is Spectrum West. Nice to have you along for the ride today. Our good friend Jim Oliver continues his watchful walk around western Wisconsin, eyes open for interesting things happening on the stages and theaters that dot our landscape. This week's production is about to happen at one of our westernmost outposts, Hudson, Wisconsin.
Agatha Christie's A Murder is Announced will be performed September 12th through the 28th at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Joining us by telephone to talk about the show and Agatha Christie is Mary Cutler, who is director of the Phipps production. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thanks for having me.
The book on which the play is based was published in 1950. Agatha Christie died, I believe, in 1977. Her play, The Mousetrap, opened in London in 1952, and I guess it's still running, having passed 25,000 performances some 3 years ago. In addition, Miss Marple and Inspector Perot's movies are on Wisconsin public television on a regular basis on Masterpiece Theater. So why is Agatha Christie's work so enduring?
Isn't that interesting? And a really good question. It seems that they were always questioning the validity of her writing interest in murder mystery. In her era, she was not a prime candidate for any literary award, except she was so popular. And in studying drama, I had, you know, come up with several names that are similarly based. And it's like in their own era, they just weren't received because they weren't as canonical as other plays and or playwrights might have been, didn't meet enough standards. And so Christie has always been shoved to a kind of a secondary rank. Oh, well, and then there's Agatha Christie kind of rapport she seems to have had, even in the early days. So it's interesting to see how we cling to Agatha Christie. I've not seen too many of her works, nor have I read them, but over the years, I've become more interested in them because I love the era. Any boomer child, I think, has undoubtedly watched the old movies in the TV room there and seen a lot of Christie and a lot of 40s films, for heaven's sakes.
According to your biography, you were on the academic side for quite a long time. How do you explain that whole concept of if somebody's too popular, therefore it can't be any good?
I don't know if a really cogent answer rests with me. I do know that as a would-be feminist scholar, that there have been lots of things that have not been canonical that have been popular plays over the centuries. They didn't meet certain standards that the people that were setting the standards, whomever those might be in the era, proclaimed not good literature. And Christie has been one of those strong ones. If you look at names like Neil Simon, there's another one. Oh, my gosh. If you don't accept Neil Simon as one of our greats in America, then it's like, my goodness, what planet are you living on? But Neil Simon in his early years was considered a comic writer and therefore not in the ilk of Miller and Williams and the more serious playwrights of a little bit previous era than his. But indeed, he was not considered to be of the canon until he gained so much popularity that I believe he was finally accepted.
The Mousetrap, for one, is noted for having a twist at the end, which the audiences are asked not to reveal. I'm not sure how that's possible anymore. But does Christie's work always have a twist at the end, or are there a variety of literary plans that she followed?
They say that. I was reading just last night where they say, and some of her dramaturgy consists of, someone was doing an academic analysis, dramatic criticism essay it was, and they were saying how the Christie setup is such that there is predictably a twist in the end that will always be a surprise, or hopefully will be a surprise. With as little as I know about dramaturgy, it's like I would say, oh, yeah, right, Agatha Christie does provide a twist at the end, as far as I know. And some of those are predictable, and also critics have said, unpredictable and therefore really implausible. They've called that of her writing, that oftentimes those endings or the plot lines themselves are implausible and therefore not good murder mysteries. But we know her name, and she's, I believe, an OBE, Order of the British Empire. So what can I say?
She is Mary Cutler, who is director of A Murder Is Announced, a production of the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Give us a brief Cliff Notes version of what the show is about.
There is an announcement in the local paper in a Christie setting that says that there will be a murder tonight taking place at Little Paddock's Chipping Cleghorn, England, of course. The people that live in this home, around whom the plot will twist, read this announcement in the paper and then have to figure it out what on earth this means, that someone would post an announcement in the local rag about a murder going to take place in their own home this evening. And all ensues from there.
Uh-huh. Talk a little bit about the cast of characters. This is community theater, after all. So what are the main characters and who are the actors who play them?
Well, of course, there's the inspector, all right? And this is a gentleman who's had some time in New York and around. His name is Jesse May. I'm to understand that he was in an earlier era in his life, also a Wisconsin boy, and now has returned to the homeland here to continue his career. Glad to have nabbed him as the inspector. Playing one of the leads is Kirsten Johnson from Minneapolis, however, Eden Prairie. I think audiences will enjoy her work. Strong actress, does a lot of work in the Minneapolis area. Mary Beth Artaud, who's also, I'm to understand, a community theater favorite in Hudson, and has also done some work in the business before she got down to having some mouths to feed, and now has retired and gone back on the stage, as twere. And local people should know that name. Ann Spradley is playing one of my major characters. Eric Olson, the same. Rusty Lavelle. These three have worked quite a bit in the Hudson area. Younger folks making their way. A new actress, however, she's a techie extraordinaire, Carla Haas. Newcomer to Hudson's stage, Amanda Chial, doing a role for me. And then a couple of walk-ons who have been around, and also having one who's been around, Scott Peterson and Mitchell Bougny, and I probably am mispronouncing that, who's doing one of his first times in a theater production. Let's see if I've forgotten anybody. Michelle Storm from the area, doing a fun role. And then, of course, Diana Swanson, who's also a favorite in Hudson and done a lot of work there doing a lead for me.
Well, let's talk about you a little bit. You went from being a professor of theater at the University of North Dakota to practicing what you were preaching in the classroom in Minneapolis-St. Paul area theater. So what led to that decision, and are you having a good time?
Well, I had a relationship calling me here in the Minneapolis area. I was a full professor at the University of North Dakota. I had done that for 18 years. I thought, boy, this relationship sounds like a healthy one for all accounts. Seemed to be something that I was interested in pursuing as well. And thought I'd try my wings in acting and directing here in the area. I've done it a couple of times before going into academe and still had a itch in my system to work on that. So I've been really grateful and very blessed to have had a nice track record here in the cities. Half maybe or 25% of the theater people in the area know my name, but nobody else does, and like to change that maybe to include more, but I'm getting around, and I enjoy it. I enjoy it. The old bug has never been killed off for wanting to be on stage and direct. I find it very rewarding.
Still doing some teaching, though, right?
A little bit, yeah. I'm doing some acting teaching for the Lexham Theater in St. Paul.
I always ask this of people who are directing and some who have done acting and directing. And which do you prefer, acting or directing?
Oh, yeah. I get that question a lot. It's interesting.
Oh, shoot. I thought it was original.
No. I didn't mean it that way. No. I get that a lot. And I think I'm able to say it doesn't matter. I enjoy both. The flip answer is whatever pays the bills, but, you know, not much is really paying bills at this point. It's kind of a prestige thing here that the reward is. And like they say, whatever one you're doing at the time, I guess that's a facile answer. Acting is what brought me to the theater, and directing kind of kept me around, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been visiting with Mary Cutler, who is director of A Murder Is Announced, a production of the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The show will run weekends from September 12th through the 28th. And for ticket information, you can contact the Phipps at www.thephipps.org. Mary Cutler, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Ooh, I suppose I have to call him sir from now on. Thank you, Jim Oliver. This is Spectrum West. Emily Saliers of Indigo Girls, just around the corner.
Support for WPR comes from the Chippewa Valley Cultural Association. In honor of National Hispanic Heritage Month, Eviscerart, a flamenco dance trio, will perform at the Heidi Center for the Arts September 11th at 7. Details and tickets at cvca.net.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Festival Theater of St. Croix Falls will present The 39 Steps tonight, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Community Arts of Fall Creek has scheduled auditions for Robin Hood, The Rescue of Maid Marian, for 7 p.m. Monday at the Bridge offices on Hillcrest Parkway in Altoona. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Here's a Spectrum memo. Sunday at the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center, it's Kids Bop Kids. The Dream Big, Sing Loud National Tour at the State Theater. Kids Bop is big, folks. Take my word for it. Mu Daiko, traditional Japanese drumming and martial arts-inspired movement, will be at the Wide Spot Performing Arts Center in Stockholm Saturday at 7 p.m. It kicks off the big fifth Wide Spot season. Their website is widespotperformingarts.org. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Nice to have you with us today. Back in the 80s, a duo called Indigo Girls were really beginning to make names for themselves. Emily Saliers and Amy Ray, writers extraordinaire, telling stories and working to answer the tougher questions of life within a haunting and notable melody and chorus. And this wasn't their first rodeo. They'd been friends since the fifth grade. Made music through high school, into college, and then crossed the threshold into the big real world. Eventually, they were nominated for the Best New Artist Grammy. And get this, they lost to Milli Vanilli, who later had the award revoked
but they did win that year for the Best Contemporary Folk Album.
Well, darkness has a hunger that's insatiable, and lightness has a call that's hard to hear. And I wrap my fear around me like a blanket. I sail my ship of safety till I sank it. I'm crawling on your shores. I went to the doctor, I went to the mountains, I looked to the children, I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions, pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find. Closer I am to find.
14 studio records, 3 live recordings, and 3 greatest hits compilations later, Indigo is still one of the 7 colors of the rainbow, and Indigo Girls are still going strong, writing separately, then collaborating on arrangements. Each has interests other than music, but music is what they do so well together. Their tour includes 3 appearances in Wisconsin, 1 at the State Theater in Eau Claire next Wednesday evening, September 10th. Emily Saliers is 50% of Indigo Girls. She and I hooked up on the phone the other day. I'm going to sound kind of like Ralph Edwards, and I date myself by saying, Ralph Edwards, this is your life. The B Band. What's that? What is the B Band?
Well, we started in high school, and we were just sort of tossing around ideas for names because we wanted to be thought of as a band rather than, we were also going by Saliers and Ray, but we wanted a band name, so the B Band was just one of the short-lived things that we picked.
Ah, cool. What'd the B stand for?
I can't discuss that.
Oh, I see. Okay. I'll just use my imagination then. How's that?
Yeah, exactly. That's the point.
So you guys have been around since the 5th grade as buddies. And you know, Emily, I always try to drive my conversations to steer away from overused anything. So I apologize for having the same curiosity. But, you know, what's the secret to a relationship that's lasted that long and that close?
Well, ironically, the secret is distance, separation, autonomy. Individualism. I mean, because Amy and I, we have been friends and we've known each other since elementary school and we're like family, but we don't put everything into Indigo Girls. You know, Amy lives out in the country and she had an independent record label, still does, and she's put out like 5 or 6 solo records. You know, and I have a more urban life. I co-own a restaurant. We do separate projects from each other. And so part of the secret of staying together that long is having a really healthy individual life. We also write our songs separately. But we share the same value systems. I mean, we're both staunch activists and involved in issues that we both believe in, and those are rarely different from each other.
Yeah.
And also, we love each other, and Amy, what Amy brings to Indigo Girls is something that I don't bring, and for me, keeps it interesting. It's like having 2 musical lives.
Cool. Let's talk about the guitars, because, you know, you guys are pretty good. Lessons? Self-taught? What? When did you start them? Way back when you guys first got together?
I started playing when I was 9, and I think Amy started at 9 or 10. I had 2 years of classical guitar lessons when I was 11.
Ooh.
And then the rest was self-taught for both of us. I think I started at the YMCA when I was 9, and then the rest of it for us was just self-taught.
Wow, guitar lessons at the Y. I don't know that I've ever heard of that.
Yeah, well, it was a long time ago.
Yes.
I remember the day really clearly. It was a purple flyer, and they passed it out. I was in 3rd grade, and they're offering different things at the Y, and one was guitar lessons, and I just jumped on it, and honestly, it immediately was like a lightning rod for what I wanted for a creative outlet, and I was only a little girl, but it was no doubt about it. It was me and guitar, and I never stopped playing.
You remember your first guitar?
I do. It was $24. It was a gut string guitar, and my cousin helped me pick it out. He was a professional musician at the time, so he took me to the store, $24. I still have that guitar. I'm really proud of it.
Cool. You know, I started just about the same time, and my parents bought me a really nice Gibson ES-125, believe it or not.
Wow.
But it didn't cost much back then. Now, after I, of course, traded it away in high school for an electric 12-string because they looked cool, the ES-125 is worth a truckload of money.
The decisions we make.
I know. Let's jump further ahead than when you were 9 getting your first guitar. Let's talk about Nights at the Dugout at Emory University. That sounded like a cool place when I was reading about it.
It was a really cool place. Other local bands played there, and it was like a campus bar. And we both, Amy and I, had transferred to Emory from our other universities. So we ended up graduating together from Emory, but she was a year younger than I was, in 1 year younger class. But we really used Emory as a springboard for our young career, because there were, you know, we had a really good following on campus. We played on campus. The Dugout was literally across the street. And it was just a fun place where everybody sang, played music, drank beer, hung out, watched sports. One of those places that can never be recreated. It made us feel like we were making progress, and sure, all we wanted to do was play live gigs. And fortunately, Atlanta had a handful of awesome places to play. You know, we played at some restaurants and some fern bars and some places where you just had to play covers, but there are also many, many places where Amy and I could play our original music, such as it was. Mm-hmm. And that's how we started to form what we really wanted to be as a band.
The voice of Emily Saliers on the telephone. She, along with Amy Ray, equals Indigo Girls. And they're coming to Western Wisconsin on the 10th of September. In fact, three Wisconsin gigs in a row. You just brought up Atlanta. I was talking a while ago with a reputed Indigo Girls fan. She mentioned it being surprising that you're from the South. Why do you think that might be? Maybe what? Because the Southern stereotype doesn't include thoughtful or well-read, and you guys are that?
Well, if you have Flannery O'Connor and, some of the greatest writers who ever lived.
That's a flash in the pan there. No,
exactly.
I'm just kidding.
Exactly. Plenty of Southern intelligentsia, but I don't know. Anybody would be surprised. Maybe, I mean, Amy's fourth generation native.
Oh, wow.
And I was born in Connecticut, but moved to Georgia with my family when I was a little girl. My parents are from Ohio, so mm-hmm. I don't have an accent or anything really, but who knows? I love the South. I love the connection to the rural life. The history, of course, is, while it's very painful, it's also the home of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Just to see all the changes over the years and study the history and be part of the culture and the land is absolutely beautiful. I couldn't live anywhere else.
A lot of good tunage comes from the South as well, so that's
kidding.
That
no
shouldn't
kidding.
Be. Oh, wow. Beauty Queen Sister, the latest. It's an indie label. It's your own. You guys talk about the need for recording much more quickly these days, I read. While that sounds kind of like a burden, it has been a good thing for you. Tell us how.
It has been, because you don't really belabor things. Like, there are some records you could spend, I suppose, months and months, and some artists do even years. And back in the day of, you know, big labels and stuff and big budgets, you know, artists and groups could spend $1 million on a record. We never did that, but we used to take more time, say 3 months, when we had bigger budgets. And I like the expediency of being very focused, of going in there, not really writing in the studio, but allowing some time for what we call happy mistakes to be made that create interesting musical ideas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I like the focus. I like that you're not wasting money. I like that you go in with a plan. And it's a fantastic feeling to create a record in this short amount of time. Because for us, you know, honestly, it's a reality. We only have so much money we can spend.
Sure, sure.
We don't really, you know, not many people sell many records anymore. But fortunately, it's not something that's become a burden, even though it's become a necessity.
Yeah. You write about important things going on in the world and going on to other people. So there's the social responsibility aspect that you guys are known for, but I like this line from one of your PR pieces. You never shy away from lavish expressions of sweet infatuations. In other words, I'm paraphrasing, you're pretty good at banging out the love song, too.
No doubt about it. I mean, that's just been my sort of easy go-to, fairly bleeding heart. Not as much now as I used to.
Sure.
I've seen too much of the real world, but yes, it is very easy for me to write a love song. I do believe in the power of love as the greatest force in our realities, and I encourage it between people. And so I write about it a lot because I like it. I like to look at it in other people, and
yeah.
I have it in my own life. So love is a great thing, and that's what I write about easily.
Very cool. You also write about the simplicity of days gone by. Are you fast lane drivers, or do you try to keep it low and slow as much as possible?
Great question. I think we're We keep it low and slow, but we're focused drivers. I'll put it that way. You know, when you need to put the pedal to the metal, you will, but only for a short stretch of the highway. Yeah, if we're going to extend this metaphor, then that's how I'd put it for us.
Back to what we were talking about, your ability to adjust. I read that even with all the longevity you have and the resilience you've shown, you have the ability, from what I read, to grow and thrive no matter what the state of the music industry. What is the state of the music industry, according to Emily Saliers?
Well, there's a lot that it's always been, and there's a lot that it's not. The state of the music industry, I'm going to try to make this short, although it's hard to do that, was very much affected by deregulation in radio in 1996 and when corporations started snapping up radio stations.
Sure.
That's changed things. The fact that the digital explosion and, you know, iTunes and downloads and streaming has completely changed things. Very few artists sell tons and tons of records, and those who do don't sell as much as they used to. So that's different. What's the same for us is that we write music for the same reasons. It just comes from our experience, our heart, and we are a touring band. And so after all these years, 30-some, we are able to keep going because we have loyal following and they come out to see us play live. And if they didn't, we wouldn't have a career, obviously. So it's a tough industry to make it. It's completely changed by digital technology. But the heart and soul of why people go to see live music is still the same.
Sure. It's a heck of a lot easier to put out music nowadays, isn't it?
It is. But by the same token, it's flooded with all kinds of entries.
Yeah.
You know, but thank goodness for people, because it's not right that music should become elite and only people with a lot of money can produce CDs or tracks or MP3s or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I went to the doctor, I went to the mountains, I looked to the children, I drank from the fountains. The less I look for answers, the closer I am to find. That, of course, is from one of your iconic songs. Is there one song, Emily, from over the years that might serve as an Indigo Girls anthem, do you think?
I would say that is one. It's definitely an anthem of a song that I've written.
Mm-hmm.
Amy's got a song called Shame on You that I think is anthemic, and she's also got a song called Let It Ring that was from a solo record that's quite anthemic. And for us, also Galileo. Those are the ones that people really sing along with. And sort of, if they were to say, what songs do the Indigo Girls, do you know by the Indigo Girls? Probably those would be the first that come to mind for people who aren't familiar with our catalog.
On the Galileo video, since you brought it up, these quotes are attributable to you. Just a quick comment about a couple of them. I've had trouble with puberty every time.
That was the video director's idea. All those things are things that he wrote.
Like the chrome of a 53 Caddy, I was shiny and stuck out. That doesn't apply to you.
He was a brilliant video director, but unfortunately I can't claim those. They just went very well with the theme of the video and the visuals.
Man, I thought we were going to get deep there for a minute.
I don't get deep.
Hey, you know, successful musicians are always thanking their fans, you know, for buying their records and attending their shows, and that's right. But you guys are one of those groups who deserve thanks from this side as well, I believe, because you write and sing about things that matter to everyone. There's an empathy and a connection that I think people feel. You guys supply words that many out here can't come up with when they're happy or they're sad or they're frustrated or they're angry or just trying to understand. You have a conscience, and people sense you don't just write something that's only designed to sell copies. So, Emily, thank you.
Thank you. What a nice thing to say. That makes me feel really good. And I have to say honestly that Amy and I love working together, and we're so grateful for our fans, and we're grateful for the power of music. So this has just been an awesome ride.
Thanks for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Al.
Emily Saliers, half of Indigo Girls. They're working on a new album. From the 2011 album, Beauty Queen Sister, this is Making Promises. All night.
sort of dude. A pat on the back, just a little far down. You cut your teeth on a drinking crowd.
Indigo Girls at the State Theater in Eau Claire, less than a week away. It's next Wednesday, September 10th. Tickets at EauClaireArts.com and via phone at 715-832-ARTS. The numbers that go along with ARTS, 2787. So it's 832-2787. Here's a quick Spectrum memo. The 50th annual UWRF Falcon Frontier Days Rodeo, man, 50 years, is next Friday through Sunday, September 12th through 14th. Performances 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday, 1 p.m. Sunday. The website is go.uwrf.edu/rodeo. Also at UWRF, the Wyman Series presents the Golden Dragon Acrobats Thursday, September 11th at 7:30 p.m. in the Knowles Center on campus. It's free and open to the public. Wow. What a show today. Loved it. Hope you did too. Next week, UW Eau Claire music alum John Raymond heads west from New York City with his Roots Trio for a Midwest tour that includes a gig backstage in Eau Claire and some master classes. We'll talk with John about what's been happening. Women farmers are what Claire Hintz is all about. She is one, and we'll get to know her passion for the earth. She lives way up there. The Madison Ballet comes to the Mabel Tainter. We'll have that story as well, and more, always more, on Spectrum West. Can't tell you how much we appreciate you being along for the ride today. It repeats tomorrow evening at 7. Friday night, 7, on the News and Classical Music Network. I'm Al Ross. See you next week.